Two macroeconomic phrases with which to concern yourselves today. Foreign direct investment is the first. The yield curve is the second. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday, today, the 28th day of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Here is what we're going to do today. Two stories to start us off. One global, really macro, big picture kind of thing. The other one also, as it happens, global, macro, and big picture. But each of them telling us something different about what our economic future might be. Story number one goes like this. In Wisconsin today, President Trump did a thing that politicians like to do, gold-toned shovel in hand. He presided at the groundbreaking for a huge new plant the electronics manufacturer Foxconn is building in Wisconsin. Foxconn, probably best known for building iPhones in China, of course. The plant is a $10 billion investment in the United States that Foxconn is making, which is a big number, yes. But the thing is that that kind of foreign direct investment, as it's known, it's actually been falling. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explains what's going on here.
Foreign direct investment, say a new plant by a foreign firm like Foxconn, that's the kind of investment we're talking about here, as opposed to some kind of investor who merely buys stock in a U.S. company. The U.S. is still the largest destination for foreign direct investment in the world, but it fell 40% in 2017 compared to the year before.
We have to ask ourselves, is this just part of a global cycle, or is this a larger structural phenomenon?
Daniel Rosen is a partner with the Rhodium Group.
And there's serious reason to be concerned that this is a more structural change.
Rosen says companies might be deterred by recent efforts from the White House and Congress to limit foreign investment in high-tech industries. And then there's the tone of U.S. leadership.
The general anti-foreign attitude, nativistic attitude we're getting out of our leadership presently is generally off-putting to firms from outside the United States.
Ken Goldstein, a U.S. economist at the Conference Board, says companies are also wary of making long-term investments because of the president's trade policy.
These tariffs that are being proposed and implemented, this is changing people's opinions about where they want to source their operations and where they want to trade to.
And the reason that matters, when companies invest here, they hire here. For example, that Foxconn plant, it's supposed to come with 13,000 new jobs for American workers. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
All right, story number two, bringing a slightly different take on our possible economic future. And I should say, apologies in advance for this, but it's a little bit weedy, a little bit technical. It's about the inner workings of the bond market, specifically something called the yield curve. Essentially, it's the difference in interest rates on short-term and long-term government bonds. The way things usually work in a growing economy like we have now is that rates on, say, the 10-year Treasury note are a good deal higher than rates on 2-year notes. The government has to pay you more, give you more interest, in other words, to borrow your money for longer periods of time. Because that's what government debt is, right? The thing is that right now, that gap between the two, the curve, is razor thin. It's almost flat, in fact. Marketplace's Jed Kim explains what's going on.
Everyone loves a trusty indicator of bad times on the way. The yield curve has been a reliable one. It's simple to read. It's got a great track record. John Cochran is a senior fellow at Stanford's Hoover Institution.
When the short-term bonds are paying more than the long-term bonds, historically, that has been one of the best signals of an upcoming recession.
The curve hasn't inverted yet, but it's pretty flat. So many are wondering if it's a case of
winter's coming.
But not everyone's going all Game of Thrones. Matthew Luzzetti is a senior economist at Deutsche Bank.
In the current environment, there are reasons to think that the signal that you're getting from it is a bit distorted.
Other macroeconomic indicators matter. Unemployment is really low, and our economy is growing. Why is the curve distorting and long-term rate returns taking a hit?
It is a result of the tremendous amounts of money still pouring in to these bonds from the central banks.
Raghuram Rajan teaches finance at University of Chicago's Booth School of Business. He says Japan and Germany's long-term bonds are at zero or even negative returns. So foreign banks might figure,
well, I can get zero here. I can get around 2.9 in the U.S. Where do I want to be?
Demand has pushed up bond prices, lowering returns. While many eyes will stay fixed on the yield curve, others might be looking over their shoulder at other risks, like, say, a trade war that could tip us into recession. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, up a little bit, slowly and steadily. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's a chance, just a chance, mind you, because healthcare is nothing if not complicated, but there's a chance that the prescription drug side of that industry got itself disrupted today. Amazon spent what is reported to be $1 billion on a company called PillPack. It's an online pharmacy that pre-sorts medications and delivers them to you, packaged right to your door. In other words, Amazon is getting into the retail prescription drug business. From the health desk at WHYY, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein explains what that is going to mean.
PillPack mails consumers a box of medications once a month. Inside are individual plastic bags with meds pre-sorted by day and time. Vanderbilt Health Policy Professor Stacy Dusetsina.
It takes a lot of the hassle out, dividing up the pills and organizing those for patients.
PillPack is tiny, currently serving tens of thousands of customers. Adam Fine with Drug Channels Institute says what attracts Amazon is the company's reach.
PillPack is legally permitted to sell prescriptions in 49 of the 50 U.S. states. So this gives Amazon instant access to the national prescription market.
Amazon has made its fortune making it easy to shop for everything from shoelaces to charcoal. Wall Street assumes Amazon is about to do the same for prescription drugs, as Walgreens, Rite Aid, and CVS lost more than $11 billion in market value in early trading today. But Morningstar analyst Vishnu Lakhraj thinks predictions of some massive retail pharmacy disruption are silly.
The healthcare market is one of the most complex markets in the world for a reason. Fundamentally, it's very hard to navigate that whole maze of how do you treat individuals optimally at the lowest cost.
But if Amazon has proven anything, it's that they know how to make shopping more convenient. And for the 70 million Americans who take at least three prescription drugs a month, getting pre-sorted pills is a lot more convenient than schlepping to the drugstore. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Merger and acquisition number two in this economy this week can be found in the frozen food aisle. ConAgra, which already owns Healthy Choice and Marie Callender's, is going to spend $8.2 billion to buy Pinnacle, purveyor of Bird's Eye vegetables and Hungry Man dinners. All in all, the company's going to generate about $11 billion in annual sales. But that's $11 billion in frozen foods when consumers' tastes are tending to the fresh. From WESA in Pittsburgh, Marketplace's Erica Barris has that story.
A frozen meal in the old days is what Warren Thayer, who runs trade magazine Frozen and Refrigerated Buyer, would call a belly filler. The kind of meal you eat when you're thinking,
well, I'm hungry, I don't give a damn what I eat. You know, it'll be high carb and high fat and high sodium and high sugar perhaps.
But these days, that's not all you find in the frozen food aisle. What shoppers want are more thoughtful, whole food-filled, ethnically inclined meals. Think less preservatives in your mashed potatoes, or just forgo them for some quinoa. And that, according to Dewey Warner, an analyst with Euromonitor,
that has created a bit of a chasm between the traditional offerings in the frozen food aisles and what consumers want.
Don Thilmany is an agribusiness economist at Colorado State University. She says in the last 2 years, frozen food sales have seen an upward turn. She attributes it to the bigger legacy companies buying and taking cues from small startups that prepare specialty meals, organic, gluten-free, no allergens, and food for people who follow specific diets.
Simplicity of wanting something that has all of the nutrients you have in one place that you can pop in a microwave or an oven.
Bill Lempert runs the website Supermarket Guru. He says meal kits, pre-made grocery store items, and the easier accessibility of taking out and ordering in have all made frozen meal companies up their game and give shoppers what they're looking for.
They want convenience.
And if companies listen to customers, there'll be more choices in the frozen food aisle. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Regular listeners to this program will know that every time we've got Molly Wood on, my go-to with her is to say something like, all right, Molly, make me smart on this, would you? And then we talk about whatever it is. We turn that into a podcast the two of us do, cleverly called Make Me Smart. And now we have turned it into something you can do if you've got an Amazon Echo. All you got to do is say, Alexa, make me smart.
Welcome back to Make Me Smart.
And then, well, take your pick.
augmented reality,
trade war,
ransomware,
the credit score,
Venmo,
why the summer blockbuster movie matters,
what 5G actually is,
why fireworks might be disappearing depending on where you live,
what targeted ads are.
Short, snappy, context on the news so we can all be a little bit smarter. Just say, Alexa, make me smart. We're going to go to Cleveland, Ohio now, the outskirts actually, for another story in our year-long series about the financial crisis and the last 10 years in our economic lives. It's called Divided Decade. Cleveland and its surroundings were hit just about as hard by the foreclosure crisis as it is possible to be hit. From 2006 to 2009, in some neighborhoods, half the properties were in foreclosure. As Marketplace's Amy Scott reports now from the Cleveland suburb of South Euclid, residents are still feeling the after effects.
Maria Torres needed a place to live fast. She'd been renting a house in South Euclid with her husband and three kids when she was told the house was in foreclosure and she had just a few weeks to get out.
So we're calling, going back and forth, like, please help us understand what's going on here. We've got kids. The kids are in school. It was just a big disaster.
Then, in the middle of all that, she noticed a sign in front of a house around the corner. It said, rent to own.
We could stay in the same neighborhood, you know, and just get out of there. We literally walked our little stuff over here, and that was it.
The house is a three-bedroom, 1920s brick colonial. When Torres's family moved in last year, it had some broken windows and the paint was peeling. But it had possibility. After a $1,250 move-in fee, they've been paying just over $400 a month in rent, much less than the going rate in their middle-class neighborhood. Nearly half that goes toward a down payment. They have an option to buy for $45,000. But there's a catch. Torres and her husband are on the hook for repairs.
It was kind of an act of desperation. Like, okay, you know, we knew that there was some things that needed to be done, but we'd rather do some work than be homeless.
Some things turned out to include 112 code violations, ranging from cracks in the driveway to dangerous wiring.
We had to repair the basement walls. We had to scrape everything off, put new ceiling up there.
They had to paint the entire house.
Put railings up upstairs in the attic.
Replace the shower in the bathroom.
Fix the flooring in all the kids' rooms.
$12,000 later, there's still a lot left to be done. Torres and her husband have good jobs. She sells insurance. He works for a bank. But a history of poor credit and bankruptcy ruled them out for a traditional mortgage. So even with all the work, they were feeling pretty good about the decision.
Got everything put together, you know, you start to see a lot of potential. And it just made us, you know, made us proud that we accomplished it. So that's why when I got your phone call, I'm like, oh, okay, here comes the carpet rip from under our feet.
That phone call came from Sally Martin, who's standing with me now in Torres' driveway. Martin is housing director for the city of South Euclid. It's her job to enforce the housing code, which puts her in the business of delivering bad news. After they talked, Torres found out she owed $3,000 in property taxes. According to her lease, she's responsible for those, too.
If you don't pay the taxes, can they put you out because that was part of your obligation?
They possibly could.
And you'd lose your $12,000, mm-hmm. And you'd lose all that you paid.
I'm in no position to pay that amount of money, like, up front.
Torres is among thousands of people still caught up in the aftermath of the foreclosure crisis. In South Euclid, 20% of homes ended up in foreclosure. Investors swooped in to buy a lot of them on the cheap, often sight unseen, with the intent of flipping them. But credit dried up. And then, says Martin,
mortgage loans were very difficult for people to obtain. And so people were looking for alternatives.
Alternatives that create income for investors and leave people like Torres with all the responsibilities of home ownership and almost none of the legal protections. Sarah Mancini, an attorney with the National Consumer Law Center, says it's the rare rent-to-own deal that actually works out.
If they miss a single payment, they can lose everything and be evicted like a tenant. So they're really not building up any equity in the home. They don't have any right to protections in the form of a foreclosure process.
Mancini says many rent-to-own and other so-called seller-financed housing schemes target low-income people of color who can't access traditional credit.
And it's partly based on the history of racial residential segregation across the country. You had this pattern of disinvestment where banks did not equally make credit available in communities of color.
Then came subprime lending and the foreclosure crisis.
And now we see this resurgence in these really predatory transactions that are, again, being targeted at these same communities of color.
Mancini says in most states, contracts like the one Maria Torres signed are illegal because landlords are responsible for keeping a property habitable, which means it's on them to fix any code violations. Like the 112 that Torres inherited and that continue to eat away at her ability to save for a down payment.
So we've kind of been just making them work for now, doing one piece by piece.
Because these risky rent-to-own deals often aren't recorded, it's impossible to know just how many are out there and how many people are still trying to emerge from the housing crisis with a home of their own. In South Euclid, Ohio, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Why can't I make ends meet? Why can't I make this math work?
If the economy is so strong, how come that keeps happening? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is up 98 points today, 0.4%, 24,216 on the blue chips. NASDAQ advanced 58 points, 0.7%, 7503. The S&P 500 increased 16 points, 0.6%, 2716. Told you about Amazon's plans to buy PillPack. Amazon shares popped 2.4% on that news. Its pharmaceutical competitors, however, came down with a bad case of the losses. Rite Aid weakened more than 11%. CVS fell 6% today. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.83%. And since we talked about the curve earlier, look at where the yield on the 2-year note landed today, 2.51%. That puts the spread between the 2 and the 10 at 0.32, which is pretty tight. A lot of numbers. I know. I apologize. You're listening to Marketplace. As a nonprofit news organization, Marketplace delivers independent public service journalism that matters. You can help us do it by becoming a Marketplace investor today. And right now, your donation in any amount could unlock a $25,000 challenge from Candida if we meet our fiscal year goal of 6,000 donors by June the 30th. So please contribute today at marketplace.org. And thanks. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. If I have said this once, I've said it a zillion times. This is a global economy. So what happens in one place can often be felt in another, especially when that one place, the first place, is the world's biggest economy, us. So with that in mind, we've got another installment of our series, My Economy, coming up. What people are actually feeling in their day-to-day lives away from the headlines. It comes to us from our colleagues at the BBC and a man who has been working in the British steel industry for more than 40 years.
Well, my name is Mark Turner. I originate from Cornwall. At one time, you know, the UK was the powerhouse of the world. Most of the things that sort of come out of the Industrial Revolution were born out of South Wales. You go places around the world and you'll see steel that was made in these valleys. I come from a very proud industry that unfortunately is seeing the back end of what was once a great, great industry. China's come into the market, India's come into the market. The main thing is overcapacity. There's more people making steel in more markets. I would love to see a UK government that did some of what Trump's doing, which is looking after or attempting to look after the steel industry or the manufacturing base in this country the same way as he's doing in America. But I think he's going the wrong way about it. If you don't make the steel within your own market, why penalise the importers who do bring in the steel that you require? It helps steel makers. I don't think it necessarily helps people in the supply chain further on. A lot of steel workers are tired and just want to know that they got a secure future, because I think that's the main thing, is none of us really know what the future holds for us or the generations behind us. And we would just like a bit of somebody to come along and say everything's okay, you're going to have jobs for the next 10 years, 15 years, because at the moment none of us know what the future holds.
Mark Turner from our friends at the BBC for our series My Economy. This thing can't happen without your help, you know, so take a second if you would, let us know how your personal economy is doing. There's a place you can do that for us at marketplace.org. There are a lot of signs this economy is doing all right. You can probably tick them off without my help, right? Record low unemployment, GDP, that is gross domestic product, is generally growing. Wages at long last starting to inch up. But those headlines don't affect economic reality for millions of people. Alyssa Quart tells the stories of some of those people, lawyers, adjunct professors, daycare workers, and teachers, trying to hang on. In her new book, it's called Squeezed, Why Our Families Can't Afford America. Alyssa, welcome to the program.
Great to be here, Kai.
I need you as a way to, it's not really establishing your bona fides because they're real, but I want you to tell me your story and how you came to this project because they are connected.
Right. Well, I was pregnant with my first child 7.5 years ago, and I was really ill. Like many women, it was a hard pregnancy, and I couldn't work. So my husband and I had been freelance writers, and we were no longer able to make the same living that we had in the past. We were living off of our savings. But it gave me a portal into the lives of many Americans who are spending 30% of their money on daycare. It was a real wake-up call for us as a family.
Yeah, you sell yourself short here. The line from the book is, we did go through a few years of fiscal vertigo. Right? It was
tough. Yeah, it was fiscal vertigo. And it was a recognition I had of what I saw amongst my friends in New York and then further out into the rest of the country, this kind of self-blame that a lot of new parents are experiencing. Why can't I make ends meet? Why can't I make this math work?
Let me circle back to the one of the themes that comes up again and again in this book, which is the value of care work. What does that mean for the strains that families come under in this economy?
I guess one of the conclusions of my book was it's really necessary for us to reframe care work societally. Mm-hmm. You know, only 14% of U.S. workers have paid maternity leave. There's still a sense that the motherhood piece of the equation is seen as a real liability.
And it's no mistake, just picking up on that, it's no error, I guess, that most of the people profiled in this book are women.
Yeah, they are. But I kind of saw in my reporting and also just in my life amongst my friends something else. I called it the motherhood advantage. And there's been research on this, too, that mothers were more productive in their jobs than women without children. And they surveyed 10,000 academics and found them a lot more productive after they had children.
Hmm. I was going to ask you the solutions question, right?
I got a bunch.
No, I know you do. And they're in the book and they're codified and organized. And I recommend this book to people who are interested in this topic because there are answers at the back end. But the more challenging question is, yeah, great, you've got the answers. But how do we get from here to there in a society and an economy that is polarized, that is seeing a huge wealth and income gap, and where we can't agree on many fundamental definitions of what life is in this country?
I mean, look, it's depressing. And I don't want to lie about this. I mean, I think it's a real uphill battle. But I also think that we could have a different relationship to maternity leave, pregnancy discrimination, universal pre-K. There's sort of small ways in which things start to change, and it's not just thrown back on the people like, make yourself healthier emotionally or figure out a DIY daycare network as some of the people in my book do. I think this is part of the self-blame that especially women have internalized, a lot of shame around having to separate their caring for their families and their labor in the workplace. And that division between work for money and our love for our kids, I think, needs to be rethought.
Alyssa Quart is the executive editor of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. Her most recent book is called Squeezed, Why Our Families Can't Afford America. Alyssa, thanks a lot. Appreciate your time.
Oh, thank you.
This final note on the way out today, a new data set from the Bureau of Labor Statistics called the American Time Use Survey, the most recent version of which came out this morning. It's literally how Americans use their time. All kinds of interesting data in there about how we work and what we do when we don't work. The one that grabbed me is this. On an average day, Americans age 15 to 44 watch, again on average, 2 hours of television per day. People in that same age group spent just 10 minutes a day reading for pleasure. I mean, what? All right, we got to go. Dow Industrial's up 98 today, 0.4%. NASDAQ up 58. That is 0.7%. The S&P 500, 16 points to the good, 0.6%, 2716. John Buckley, Eve Epstein, Stephen Gregory, John Gordon, Danielle Irby, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Deirdre Dempke. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.